This is Jessica Yellen, host of the News Not Noise podcast and newsletter and former chief White House correspondent for CNN. I am your guest host today. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the last week of May, and yet another tragic mass shooting at an elementary school. At least 19 children and two teachers were killed at a Texas elementary school on Tuesday. This is one of the worst school shootings since Sandy Hook nearly 10 years ago. The nation responded in horror and dismay that this is happening yet again, with politicians unable to find agreement on reforms that could reduce the catastrophic number of mass shootings in this country. There have been 212 mass shooting incidents in 2022. According to the World Population Review, the U.S. has the world's highest number of mass shootings. So what is happening in this country, and what can we do to reverse this deadly trend? Let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. I am your guest host and your center. I'm joined by Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic on the left. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me on.
And on the right is Ovik Roy, president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity and policy editor at Forbes. Ovik, hi.
Hi, Jessica.
Thanks to both of you. And let's just start by saying it is painful to have to discuss this topic. This is the second week in a row that we have started this show by asking panelists, how are you feeling about a gun massacre? And what are your thoughts about how the nation is processing this news? Liz, I'll start with you. You're from Texas and you have young children. What are your thoughts today?
I'm from Texas. I have young children, but I live in Connecticut, not far from Sandy Hook. And already I can see parents in these areas responding because they still remember Sandy Hook very vividly. The way that I've responded is made me a stranger to myself. I've never had much trouble with gory details. I've witnessed a couple of executions. I've read plenty of autopsy reports. I've seen postmortem photos. I've read through rape kits, which include lots of details. I've interviewed rape victims, child rape victims. I've interviewed FBI agents who specialize in child sexual violence. But I have found myself unable to pursue details about the news. For instance, the fact that the shooter was apparently barricaded into a single classroom and all the children were killed in the single classroom means there was a last child.
Ovik, your thoughts?
Well, I actually do live in Texas and I'm the father of young children, but I'm in Washington, D.C. this week, so I've not been around my neighbors and community to have a sense of their reactions to outside of my own family. But obviously, our hearts go out to everyone, all the families of the victims and the whole state, the whole community is reeling, clearly. And, you know, there's very little to add to that other than I think that as we often do in the aftermath of these shootings, we're trying to think about what can we do, what possibly can we do to reduce their incidents or eliminate their incidents in the future. And I think I've been actually somewhat encouraged, but I feel like we're having a more empirically oriented conversation about that, and I hope that continues.
I'll add that I'm hearing from people in my audience that this is making them feel helpless. They feel like nothing they can do or say makes a difference. And I look at other nations around the world that have less access to guns and no epidemic of mass shootings, and it seems that the data tells a story. In fact, yesterday I was talking to my team and we were looking at a graph pulled together by USA Facts. It shows firearms deaths from 1981 till now. And the 20-year-olds on my team pointed out a part of the graph where firearm deaths fell for a stretch of years. And they asked me what happened there. And that just happened to be from 1994 to 2004, the decade assault weapons were banned in this country. given that the data tells this story, it just continues to perplex so many people. Where is the political will to act on it? Ovik, I want to ask if you have thoughts or you want to respond to that before I move on.
Well, I do think there is a political will to act on it. I think where there's a debate as to what can actually reduce mass shootings. And the standard thing you hear from the left side of the fence is, well, if we restrict assault weapons, et cetera, that could make a marginal difference. And maybe it could, but we had an assault ban, and we still had assault weapons ban, and we still had mass shootings. Most of the mass shootings actually occur. There was a study that was done by the National Institute of Justice just published 4 months ago that found that 77% of all mass shootings involved handguns, not assault weapons, not automatic weapons. So yes, could some of these things make a difference on the margins, but it won't solve the problem on its own. 80% of the mass shootings were conducted with guns that were stolen from a family member or a household member. So it's really hard to, I mean, there are obviously policies out there about restricting purchases of guns or expanding background checks. And here's an example of a case where this young man passed a background check. Right, he turned 18. He bought the guns, and then he shot up the school. So, and the school itself also had safety protocols. So, all that to say that I think this is a specific case that defies some of the obvious policy recommendations that have been out there. But I do think more broadly, there are some things that we can do, and not all of it, by the way, is about passing laws. Some of the stuff around, say, red flag policies, or how do we alert authorities to people who seem to be expressing the signals that might lead them to be a mass murderer in the future? Are there things we can do, not just at the legal level or the police level, but can we help ordinary people notice these signs in a kind of PSA or public service way to help authorities identify these potential risks in the future? I feel like if we could do more of that, we might make a lot of progress here.
Liz, I hear Ovik say that some of these changes may improve things on the margins, but those margins could, in theory, save lives. And red flag laws are one of the interventions used to address mental health crises. So of all these policy options, Liz, what do you think are the right solutions to reduce the number of mass shootings?
Yeah, you can do a PSA campaign to make people more suspicious of their neighbors than they already are. We're an extremely low trust society. You'll get a lot of people reporting just depressed people, bullied people, people who are queer or whatever. And then instead of someone showing up who can help these individuals, you get what? Cops? I mean, it's not like we have any kind of department or agency that shows up to offer you therapy and psychiatric care or medication, much less long-term treatment. So what, the police show up and shake you down for being a weirdo? That sounds great. I'm sure that'll be effective. And then we have the Harden the Targets brigade, which is, limited to one door. Add armed security, arm the teachers, potentially, that kind of thing you're hearing out of Ted Cruz and so forth, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick. You've got a very low trust society, and it's ridiculous to behave as though you're not losing something profound when you agree to turn a kindergarten into a prison with armed guards. You're admitting that yes, we have to surround our kindergartens with armed guards to keep all the killers out. Our society has a problem. We have all these people we produce that want to murder all the children and have the means to do it. What the hell? That's a nightmarish wasteland. What is going on in this society? It's not just a question of why do these people have the means to commit these mass murders readily available to them? That's a good question. Why should an 18-year-old be able to go purchase a couple of ARs? Why? What do you need those for? What the hell do you plan to do with that? That's a reasonable question. If I try to go buy, 4,500 pounds of fertilizer, guess what? The government's going to ask me what I plan to do with that. I have to either produce some kind of evidence that I'm actually an industrial farmer, or they're going to say, no thanks, no way. And by the way, what do you think you're doing? You know what? I have the same question about an 18-year-old buying a couple of ARs. Okay, so prove to me you've got a feral hog problem or something like that, or get the hell out of here. The answer is no. And you know what? Maybe he would have stolen it or something else and yada, 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 but why did it have to be so easy? And I think the obvious thing that occurs to a lot of people is that there are solutions, yes, that would help at the margins and so on and so forth. And I have nothing against those solutions, hardening the targets, making the schools safer. I mean, I have young children. If there's a problem with madmen running around trying to kill children, then yeah, I guess in that case, I'm going to agree. Please station the armed guards around the schools, put up the gates, make the schools hard targets. But it is extremely distressing to live in a society where you feel like your kid is prey. Why the hell is it like that? It wasn't always like that. It's not like that in other places.
Ovik, teachers complain to me all the time that they have no policy or system in place to address kids who do show red flags, that somebody will come to their attention with distressing signals, that they're having mental health issues, they want to know if they have access to guns, and there is no action plan to address this. Do you object to red flag laws? And if so, what is the solution? What is the right intervention in this situation?
First of all, no, I don't object to red flag laws. And I think that to make myself very clear, and I agree with a lot of what Liz said. I mean, look, these are incremental improvement is not zero improvement, and we should be for incremental improvement. And I certainly am. I think what I'm trying to express is that we should be clear with the public when we talk about some of these initiatives that they are incremental improvements, right? That we are not going to be solving the problem with some of these improvements. They may help incrementally with the problem. They may reduce the incidence of mass shootings. But at the end of the day, when a lot of the problem is with the guns that have already been purchased, that are already in households, there's more that we need to do to rely on everyday people to secure the guns they have, to make sure they can't get stolen. To your point, we need to revisit the way we handle discipline in schools. As you said, it's not just a problem with mass shootings. It's a problem for educational outcomes as well. A big driver of poor educational outcomes is often going to school in a relatively dangerous environment where a lot of bad actors are able to do whatever they want. The teachers are intimidated. The other students are intimidated. So that's a pretty significant social problem that goes way beyond these exceptionally tragic situations like the one we're talking about today.
May I follow up with you on that, Ovik? There is a national consensus on background checks, and I'm emphasizing this because there is some common ground here. Quinnipiac found 89% overall approval, and 70% of Republicans support expanded background checks, but this keeps getting blocked at the Senate. Why can't even this pass Congress?
You know, I mean, the problem with the NRA, and this is not just an NRA problem, this is a problem that a lot of single-issue groups that influence Congress, the way they act, they make this slippery slope argument, right? If you accept restrictions in some way on my thing, then basically if you impose speed limits of 55 miles an hour, then eventually the speed limit will go to zero, right? And that's, of course, ridiculous. But that's generally been the posture of the NRA, that any prudential regulation is on the slippery slope to confiscation of all guns in America. And you just can't think that way. You can't operate that way. It basically prevents us from doing things that we need to do, whether it's on gun regulation or any other issue. So that's a problem. And the NRA's standing has of course been affected by some of their internal challenges of late. But the members of Congress, at a certain point, I think, have to say, okay, I respect the gun owners in America. I respect the members, people in my constituency who are members of the NRA. I respect their Second Amendment rights, but at the same time, we've got to do these prudential things like making sure that background checks are as robust. And again, it's worth reiterating that in this particular case, the young man did pass a background check. And that gets to, in a sense, not so much a loophole, but a flaw or an Achilles heel in background checks as a policy, which is that when you turn 18, you generally haven't developed the background that can be checked, right? So what we're finding with a lot of these mass shootings, particularly of late, is that they are, generally speaking, young men in that sort of 18 to 24 age year age bracket. And so we have to think a little bit more about, and part of it may be raising the age threshold, right? So in Texas, for example, Liz mentioned that, well, you can buy a gun at 18. That's been true since 1968. That is not a new development. So you could say, well, let's raise the age threshold for buying guns. But the question is, why is the epidemic happening now and it wasn't happening before? And that speaks to this point about the dissolution of the social fabric, that's a deeper and harder question to answer.
A lot of common ground and a lot of ideas there. Let's discuss on the other side of this break. I'll be back with Liz Brunig and Ovik Roy to continue the conversation about gun politics in America. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise and former chief White House correspondent for CNN. On the right is Ovik Roy, president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity and policy editor at Forbes. On the left, Liz Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. Liz, we've been talking about the NRA, and we know they're enormously influential. They generously fund and lobby effectively and hold the line at a zero gun reform policy, period. At the same time, Democrats who support gun safety reforms hold the White House, the House, and the Senate. Yes, it's a 50-50 Senate, but background checks is a 90% issue. So do Democrats lack the strategic skill to get some of this done? What should the party be doing differently?
I think there's a lot going on here. I think for one thing, the NRA is not the organization it once was. I think the GOP at this point would sort of prefer to blame the NRA for, you know, all of its misdeeds with respect to guns, precisely for the reasons you indicate, because quite a lot of these gun reforms are becoming extremely popular public policy nationwide. Even the GOP likes to suggest that, the NRA is this powerful membership organization and therefore they're a constituency to be reckoned with. In reality, the NRA, you know, has been tied up in lawsuits for a while and they don't really have the capacity to make the outlays they once did. Guns are a grassroots issue. GOP voters care about guns. The reason that the GOP acts the way it does with respect to guns is because it is reacting to its voters. It's reacting to its base. And the reason that the United States has, you know, an insane gun policy is because to some degree, that's what Americans want. And so you see these policies like background checks that, you know, show broad-based support, and then you start to see politicians try to work on them, and they have broad-based pushback, which is a strange phenomenon. But there's a difference between polling and legislation, and when, you know, media picks up the legislation, people have a certain response to seeing those policies actually come into being. And I think gun reforms, conservative media has an especially easy time turning into a hyper-reactive culture war issue. You factor in that there's a sort of crime wave conversation unfolding on the right at the moment. I think those are the perfect conditions to create pushback against even something that otherwise people seem fairly comfortable with. And it's extremely disturbing because obviously we need to get guns out of circulation and stop adding guns to circulation. It's very simple. And, you know, I think the most obvious solution to at least start out with is buybacks. I don't know why Democrats aren't spending more time with that. We have plenty of money. We're a rich nation. We're also a very unequal nation. A lot of guns, you know, a lot of gun crime takes place among poorer people, right? These are people who could use some money. People who are poor are more likely to be victimized by violent crime, by the way. So this is of special importance to these communities. So why not just set up a buyback program? Everything's going to sell at some price. Mm. Buy them back. Melt them down. Throw them into a volcano. Who cares? Remove them from circulation and stop adding them into circulation.
Oh, Vic, one of the messages I receive often from people on social media is that they think America is broken. They feel hopeless and they feel bereft. We can't even come up with policies to address the fact that little kids are being killed at school. What would you say to that?
Well, we have a lot of problems in this country. That's one of many. I think I wouldn't say America's broken. You know, Bill Clinton used to say there's nothing that's wrong about America that can't be fixed by what's right about America. And I that really speaks to me, and I think a lot of other people, that there are a lot of people in America who are obviously responding to this tragedy with great concern. And that should speak to how good this country is, right? That we have a lot of people who really do want to solve the problem. Yes, our political system is not meeting the standard and has a lot of challenges. And there's a lot to talk about in terms of how we reform our political system to meet Americans where they are. But I wouldn't say it's America that's broken. I would say it's our political system needs improvement. I mean, just to go back to the question about, you know, the Republican base, say, on guns. I mean, according to Pew, 93% of all gun-owning households support background checks for all gun buyers. So this is not a matter of even the GOP base that's really objecting here. There is a single-issue organization that is threatening members of Congress and making them fear and perceive that if they don't toe the line, they will be politically harmed in an environment in which winning the primary is much more important than winning the general election. So that's a structural problem that we've engineered. But I would also say that a big part of the problem, and not just with this issue, but with many issues, the perception that politicians have of the power of these special interest groups is exaggerated. That in fact, if you actually go to the voters and ask them what they want and are responsive to them, you do just fine. And Joe Manchin's a great example, right? He's in West Virginia. West Virginia is a very pro-gun state. He is a moderate on gun issues. He has advocated legislation that's a lot along the lines of the things that we've been talking about. He has not been punished for doing so. And I wish that more members of Congress had that confidence in advocating for their constituents' interests.
Ovik, I so agree with you on this one. And I've been explaining that this is a question of voter intensity as well. You know, electeds know that if they enact any gun safety reforms, the NRA will stop funding them or come after them. And it is a top issue for the NRA. And on the other hand, voters who care about background checks and want red flag laws say that, but it's not a top voting issue for them. Or they tell pollsters and electeds that won't determine their vote. And if, you know, people out there who care about this start telling elected officials, I'm not going to vote for you unless you back this, that's when public voices can rival one special interest group. But I think there's also a lot of difficulty in sort of helping people understand that and understand how to make their voices heard and actually exert that political pressure on their elected officials.
I think that's right. I think one thing I would add is that, is there a way to convince the gun advocates who are aligned with the NRA but maybe not on 100% of the way there, to say, look, we're not trying to prevent you from owning guns. We are just trying to make sure that we preclude or prevent these tragedies or reduce their incidence, and we're pro-safety. Can we do things together? And the NRA, in its best life, is a pro-gun safety organization. So in theory, at least based on the NRA's own stated principles, there ought to be a way to appeal to pro-gun constituencies in a way that is aligned with a lot of things we're talking about.
Absolutely. Liz, the Supreme Court is poised to issue its first big Second Amendment ruling in a decade. They're considering a challenge to a New York State concealed carry law. Now, if they loosen gun restrictions, which is expected, where does the gun safety movement go from there?
I mean, you loosen gun restrictions, you know, you have more guns in circulation. You know what's going to happen. We know what's going to happen because we can look at the United States in comparison to other countries of comparable development, and we can see that our higher homicide rate and suicide rates and mass murder rates and school shootings are all driven by the extremely high number of guns we have in circulation. And so I think it's fair to take a wild guess that if we add even more guns into circulation, all of those measures on which we're already very high compared to other countries that are comparably developed will get even higher. I don't know why we want to do that. I guess someone's going to make some money off of it. But it seems like some kind of existential suicide. It's a way of life with no regard to the future, total disregard to the future, which is ghastly. It's completely baffling to see people behave in this way. It's a tool, right? It has a purpose. There's a thing it's supposed to do. The presumption shouldn't be that you have unlimited access to these things. And then, you know, eventually someone might be able to come up with a theory of why not. Should be the case that you provide a story about why you need this thing. This is how it works in other countries. If you're a farmer or something and you're dealing with vermin, that's one thing. You might need one of these tools. If you're an 18-year-old kid, what the hell do you need a couple of ARs for? But we're so philosophically backwards in this country, and it manifests in a variety of ways, and this is one of those ways. And people are attached to the philosophical disorder in American life. They like the ways in which we are screwed up. That's why we're screwed up. And so, of course, they don't want to let it go, and that's going to be a major legislative battle. It's going to be a major court battle. It's going to be an activist battle. It has to do with persuasion and whether we can convince people that, you know, some foundational elements of the American outlook on life are, you know, actually somewhat mistaken and they're not sufficiently other regarding, you know, and I hope that's successful.
Ovik, some states are moving in the direction of fewer gun safety policies. Last year, Texas passed a permitless carry bill. Ohio just signed into law a constitutional carry bill. So did Georgia. One's nearing passage in Louisiana. Meantime, in California, they're moving gun control legislation that would make it possible to sue gun manufacturers if their gun is used illegally. The law is sort of novel and based on the logic of the Texas abortion ban. Do you think the states are where gun laws should be legislated?
Well, states certainly have an opportunity, but things can go wrong at the state and local level as well. I mean, we remember the stop and frisk policies of the Bloomberg and Giuliani administrations as something that drove de Blasio to the mayoralty as something that was racially biased policing. But we forget often that stop and frisk was actually a gun control policy. It was a campaign by the police to get illegal guns off the street by stopping and frisking people they suspected of carrying illegal weapons. And so while, yes, there are perhaps opportunities for states to find ways to experiment with gun laws, again, they can backfire. They can not prevent shootings. We've had mass shootings in California, despite California's approach to gun control policy. And again, that is not to say we shouldn't try to think of ways to improve where we are, but just again to be rigorous about measuring the success of these policies. And I think one thing that you hear from a lot of gun rights advocates is they say, well, people don't respect our rights and are just willing to try a lot of different things and just don't care whether the outcomes are there. And I think where there is the broad political consensus is people are open to doing things that really do end up solving the problem. That's where you see that strongest amount of support, like with background checks. And so can we identify the opportunities to actually successfully reduce shootings, whether they're mass shootings or not. Well, you know, suicide is the number one component of gun deaths, and that's obviously not generally a mass shooting, but it's also a very important problem to solve. So let's hope that states can experiment a little bit and see if they can come up with policies. And I think one of the things that's troubling and disturbing about this Texas case is that Texas was doing some of the good things. They did have, in Uvalde in particular, a protocol in place for safety, and it didn't work out. And so that's something that I think is going to cause, hopefully, a lot of people in Texas to think about what to do next.
I've been talking with Elizabeth Brunig and Ovik Roy. We'll be back. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jessica Yellen, founder of News Not Noise. On the right, Ovik Roy, president of the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity. On the left, Elizabeth Brunig, staff writer at The Atlantic. We're going to shift now to overseas. The war in Ukraine is in its fourth month, and Russia continues its bombardment of the Donbas region in particular. We're joined now by our special guest, Dr. Evelyn Farkas. She is the executive director of the McCain Institute at Arizona State University. From 2012 to 2015, she served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Russia and Ukraine, and also many other titles. Hi, Dr. Farkas. Good to be with you.
Hi, Jessica. Great to be here. And you can call me Evelyn, of course.
Well, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said during a World Economic Forum event on Wednesday that Ukraine would fight until it regained all of its territories. To you, Evelyn, is this a realistic hope at this point, keeping in mind former Secretary of State Kissinger suggested not so much?
Well, I don't think it's realistic if you include Crimea, simply because the Russian military position there is strong. They seem to have the support of the population. They have nuclear-capable Iskander missiles there. It's just not realistic. And frankly, the history of Crimea suggests that the end result there will be some kind of shared sovereignty reached at through a legal arrangement, internationally arbitrated, and after Vladimir Putin is removed from the scene or leaves the scene politically in the Kremlin. With regard to the rest of the territory, though, I do think it's realistic, given the fact that we are now giving Ukraine the type of weapons they would need to launch an offensive, meaning attack helicopters coming from the Chechia in particular, the howitzers that we're sending them, the tanks that they're getting from several countries, the more capable and extended air defense systems. So all of these things together, if they get them in sufficient quantities, continue to have access to the intelligence that we're providing them, and then also get good operational advice from our military experts, the Ukrainians could take the offensive and take the territory back.
So just to nail that down, what could a peace look like there? It could be an intact Ukraine that Russia just accepts?
Well, yes, if Russia is pushed out and militarily defeated, in essence, so pushed out in such a fashion that they recognize they can't go back and reclaim Ukraine or try to reclaim it, then it will be for a fait accompli. And then the Russian government will have to accept the fact that at the end of all of this, they have a presence in Crimea that is not recognized by the international community, but they are no longer present in Ukraine. In the rest of Ukraine.
Let me ask you about some of the current sort of rumors and rumblings. First of all, there are all these rumors Putin has cancer. And there are also, though, even more importantly, indications that elites in the country are unsettled by the state of the economy and by the global isolation, and that Putin's hold on power might be tenuous. Is there an increasing chance Putin leaves power in the not distant future, or is that just a Western mirage?
I think, Jessica, there is an increasing chance that Vladimir Putin does not stay in power. much longer. And yes, he is immortal, and apparently he has cancer. But leaving that aside, because we don't really have a lot of information on that, frankly, is the reality that he relies on his power base, which is essentially enabled by the so-called Siloviki, so the security officials around him, people who, like him, grew up in the Russians and the Soviet security services, his national security advisor, chief among them, Nikolai Patrushev. And he relies on the military support. And there is a lot of discontent right now among military, members of the military. We don't know how much of the elite, so the senior military, but it could get to a point where the military goes to the people around Putin and says, look, we can't fight this war anymore. We refuse to do it. And then if Vladimir Putin refuses to stop the war, the people around him, again, the security elite, could engineer a change in government. It would be one of them. It wouldn't be, you know, pro-Western, but they likely would not have the same neo-imperialistic vision for the Russian Federation, meaning expanding and grabbing territory from their neighbors.
This next question is partly about you. The Russian Foreign Ministry announced this week that it was permanently banning nearly 1,000 Americans from ever entering the country again. They said it was in response to the United States' support of Ukraine and the sanctions imposed on Russia. This list included President Biden and Vice President Harris and you. What did you do to offend them?
Well, I'm in good company. I'm certain that I offended them by providing military assistance and, you know, advice to President Obama to help the Ukrainian government resist the Russian attempt to overrun their country. And I've been very outspoken, of course, about the threat posed by Vladimir Putin and his Kremlin to not just Ukraine, but the international order. Being banned from Russia for life doesn't make me happy because it's a beautiful country with delicious food, phenomenal buildings and cities and people. But as long as Putin and his ilk are in the Kremlin, I don't want to go there anyway because it's not safe, frankly. This is a government that kidnaps Americans. Right now they're holding two Americans, one of whom they've been holding for 2 years. That is another element of their, frankly, you know, terrorist foreign policy approach towards the international order.
Ovik, let me bring you in. The U.S. is pouring money and support into Ukraine. This is one of the few issues on which there seems to be overwhelming bipartisan and public support. Do you think, though, that that has a limit? Do you think voters start to resent the spending, or do you think the U.S. stays united in supporting Ukraine's fight?
I think so far so good. I think what the president has done he's landed where the public is, which is to say that I think there's deep skepticism and concern about American troops or NATO troops fighting directly in Ukraine, but there's broad support for arming Ukraine. And I think if anything, I've been concerned that the president has been too cautious in terms of, for example, delivering advanced M1 Abrams tanks and other advanced weaponry that could help Ukraine resist the Russians. Right now, there's this narrative out there, particularly in America and in the West, that, well, Russia's already lost this war, the Ukrainians are going to roll them back. Right now, the Russians are making territorial gains slowly but steadily, particularly in Luhansk. And it's not clear that the Ukrainians will be able to push them all the way back. I think they can if we arm them sufficiently well enough. But the military wonks that I rely on for expertise on this stuff, they say that we need to send more, and we are being fairly careful and fairly slow in delivering the kind of support that Ukraine can use to retake the territory that's been lost.
Evelyn, this past week, President Biden has been in Asia as part of the pivot to Asia that he tried to do before the war on Ukraine. We know that China has been watching the U.S. and the Western alliance's efforts to push back Russia with China's own eye on Taiwan. Now, President Biden went off script this week when he veered from longstanding policy, which is called strategic ambiguity, and said that the U.S. would use military force to defend Taiwan from Chinese aggression. It's not the first time he said that, but this time aides walked back the comments. So what's your read? Should this policy change? Was that a deliberate two-sided message, or is this giving China an important warning?
Well, I think it's a mix. So I do think it's giving China an important warning, which is that if China uses military aggression against Taiwan, regardless of its status, you know, according to international law, you know, the United States has a commitment to defend the Taiwanese people. We've been for years, way longer than we've been helping Ukraine, we've been helping the Taiwanese, you know, deter China from taking military action against them. And so we have, in a sense, a deeper commitment there. But what I think President Biden was not trying to do was to signal that we recognize an independent Taiwan or anything like that. Strategic ambiguity maintains. And in fact, Secretary Blinken, Tony Blinken, gave an address in Washington, D.C. And there he said, we don't recognize the sovereignty of Taiwan. So again, I think what President Biden was trying to say is that if Russia uses military aggression if China uses military aggression the way Russia has done in Ukraine, then China should expect at least as much assistance being provided to the Taiwanese people as we're providing to Ukraine, if not more, given our history with Taiwan.
And may I ask you for a brief answer on this one, Evelyn? What's the danger? How high is the danger level that China will move on Taiwan right now, in your view?
I think it's lower and it's relatively low. And that's because the Chinese have been watching what happened with Russia. And again, as I said, given the fact that our commitment to Ukraine has been less significant, less longer lived, and less bipartisan, the Chinese can only take the president's comment as a warning.
Liz, you know, the administration's focus on Asia this past week is about countering China's growing influence and strengthening U.S. ties to allies in the region. But while Biden was there, China and Russia did a joint military exercise with nuclear-capable aircraft in the region. That's pretty aggressive. There's a view in the administration that China poses a real threat to the international order. The administration has quietly continued some of Trump's policies, including tariffs against China, but they still walk back Biden's line on Taiwan, and they're, you know, in this place of not wanting to be as aggressive as the Trump administration, but still be forceful. Is it time for a change of policy?
No, it's. I mean, I always kind of advocate de-escalation. You know, I feel like we should be working towards a peaceful wrap up in Ukraine, and you know, not let's say using Ukraine against their will to sort of cripple Russia in the long term for our own reasons, even at Ukraine's own expense. And I likewise think that you know, it could be potentially disastrous for the United States, both economically and, you know, potentially in many other ways, to antagonize China directly. I mean, you know, economically, we're already sort of struggling at the moment with inflation as it is. You know, I would be content to just leave them alone. If as Dr. Farkas is saying, you know, they're not doing anything to Taiwan right now. So I don't see any reason to ramp up aggression. You know, Biden made his remarks about Taiwan. That seems like enough of a statement on the joint military exercise. You know, we do very aggressive things like that with respect to our military and showmanship all the time. But nor do we go around entertaining the sense that we're constantly right on the verge of nuking someone. I don't think any American thinks that's right about to happen. And I pray that every other world leader would prefer that not to happen. And I wish we were more explicit in our foreign policy about preferring and striving towards a global peace, as opposed to this sort of brinksmanship policy we seem kind of happy to inhabit.
Dr. Farkas, North Korea just launched 3 missiles and possibly an ICBM into the sea. Should we be worried about North Korea using the current instability to do more than launch test missiles?
Well, I mean, Jessica, I think we should always be worried about what North Korea might do, how it might miscalculate. They are dealing internally, according to The Economist and other press reports, with a COVID outbreak that they probably are not well equipped to manage, because they rejected vaccines that were offered to them earlier in the cycle of the pandemic, so in the first year or so. These launches may be targeted actually more at drawing the North Korean people's attention away from their woes. But I would say that we obviously need to try to engage the North Koreans in dialogue, but I'm not very optimistic right now as to whether we can offer them anything. I think our best bet is to continue to demonstrate resolve and unity with our allies in the transatlantic and trans-Pacific scenarios or in those contexts. And North Korea should understand that anything they do that is crossing a line in terms of international law and threatening to South Korea and other and Japan and other allies of the United States will bring more danger upon them. So, you know, again, I'm a strong proponent of deterrence. Just, you know, have the door open and have a dialogue, but make sure that you deter.
Special guest, Dr. Evelyn Farkas. She is the executive director of the McCain Institute at Arizona State University. Evelyn, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jessica.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's on your mind?
What else could be on my mind this week other than the tragedy in Texas? Normally, I use this segment to come up with something funny and relatable, or at least something I think that could be relatable or something that could make you laugh. This is based on my feeling that regardless of whatever our politics are, we're generally more alike than we are different. I want to believe that. And I still want to believe that. And I want to believe that it's so true that there's one thing we can all definitely agree on. And that's that we love our children. And we want them to grow up and be happy and have long, healthy, and rich lives. I really, really, really want that more than anything. In fact, it's the only thing I want. I want that for everybody and everybody's children. I really hope it's enough to change some policies in the coming months.
Ovick Roy, what's your rant?
I've been thinking a lot about a topic that we talk about a lot in Washington, and that's income and wealth inequality, because one of the biggest drivers, if not the biggest driver of wealth inequality that nobody ever talks about is the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve, and this is something that's not well understood outside of financial circles, the Federal Reserve prints a lot of extra money and by lowering interest rates, basically massively enriches banks and financial institutions and financial entities at the expense of ordinary people whose purchasing power goes down. At the Foundation for Research on Equal Opportunity, two of our scholars, John Hartley and Jackson Mejia, just completed a study looking at a 20-year period in which inflation was actually relatively low, but where as a result of the compounding effect of inflation on wealthy people versus lower income people, wealthy people have homes, they have 401ks. And so when things are going well and money is flowing from the Fed into the financial institutions, they make a lot of money. But the average person who still has to go to the grocery store and fill up the gas tank, their purchasing power declines. And we found there was a 71% difference between purchasing power for lower income people and higher income people from the period from 2004 to 2020. So the regressive impact of what the Federal Reserve has done over the last 20, 30 years requires a closer look from policymakers and from the Fed.
My rant is about teenage girls' mental health and the stunning silence of politicians who say they want to protect children. On June 18, 2020, the CDC reported a 51% increase in suspected suicide attempts by teenage girls ages 12 to 17 during the pandemic. 51%. The number of teenage girls who visited emergency rooms with eating disorders doubled during the pandemic. So we know the pandemic was traumatic, yes, but why did it hit girls so much harder than boys? To be clear, girls aren't the only group struggling. Boys are four times more likely to die of suicide than girls, and depression and anxiety rates are off the charts for LGBTQ teens. Those numbers are horrifying, too. A new CDC report says the pandemic created intense pressure that made teen life more difficult, including, quote, whole family stress. Okay, so why is it hitting girls hardest? Are they more sensitive to disruption at home? Is the increased screen time and the already documented impact of social media on girls having an effect? If it were me, I'd start a congressional inquiry right there. It's been a year. I want a White House task force, congressional hearings, elected officials running for office to make this a priority issue. The kids aren't all right. Adults who want to help the children, this should be a top priority. And I'll end by also saying thank you to everyone at KCRW and all of you listeners for having me as your guest host these past 6 weeks. I've had a great time being civilized yet provocative with you, and I look forward to next time. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks to Ovik Roy, Elizabeth Brunig, and Dr. Evelyn Farkas. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Laura Dine-Million. Our production assistant is Sarah Singer-Schiff. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Jessica Yellen. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.